cool to be.
I'd like us all to be one big community.
Not necessarily the most politically correct.
I surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life that
you've let somebody drill into your head?
It's podcast 104 for January 2014. Thank you for downloading us.
This month, after the caring is over, what do parents of disabled children do when their kids don't need them anymore? It's a conundrum for a mum and campaigner who's now using all of those years of material in stand-up comedy.
And what is the purple pound? We'll be talking about the spending power of disabled people later and working out why we're now giving it a colour.
And just after the lovely lady reminds you what our names are and just what you're listening to, we'll be easing into our first show of the year with a look at some of the recent talking points.
Don't even think about going anywhere.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
Hello. So, rather like botcher and badger watching, we're going to do a couple of things which we don't normally do. We're going to introduce everybody who's joining us today in the studio right at the top of the programme rather than introducing you one by one, mavericks that we are. So, firstly, I'm going to say hello to Nikki Clark. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Now, you are the mum and campaigner who we referred to in the intro. You've got two children, Emily, 16, and 19-year-old Lizzie.
Yep.
That is correct. Good. Who are both on the autistic spectrum. Now, we're going to chat to you in greater depth in about 15 minutes, but I would like you to chime in whenever is appropriate when we introduce the other two guests.
Well, indeed. The same goes for you, Marianne Rankin. Marianne is mother to a 37-year-old with Down syndrome, and you have another son who has also had 12 years of a depressive illness. So, like Nikki, you're familiar with that caring role, is that right?
I am, and it never stops.
Indeed. And you're also a disability consumer consultant and one of those behind the Really Useful Stuff website that sells accessible equipment.
Yes, I am.
And our third contributor today is Ouch regular Simon Minty, here to help us get the ball rolling. Hello, Simon.
Hi there, Rob.
How the devil are you? Good.
He who needs no introduction, no explanation, you're just Simon Minty.
The myth, the man, the legend.
Thank you very much.
Russell, should we... It's Heather Mills, isn't it? Let's talk about Heather.
It is. Now, we were all looking forward, especially me, to seeing whether model-turned-vegan restaurant owner-turned-skier Heather Mills would make it into the 11th Winter Paralympics in 2014. But just before Christmas, the news broke that Heather might not be getting there.
The International Paralympic Committee is seeking to take disciplinary action against Heather Mills after alleging the former model verbally abused and physically harassed an official. Mills announced on Monday that she was to abandon her bid to ski at the 2014 Sochi Paralympic Games after the IPC ruled her new prosthetic leg had not been ratified. Here's the IPC spokesman, Craig Spence.
She verbally abused our head of officiating in front of 10 other people. There are coaches who back up the fact that she was verbally abused. She was harassing her, pushing her and saying some very unkind things to someone who has over 25 years experience. Absolutely disgraceful behaviour, and we expect better from our athletes.
Well, Mills denied these charges and has since told BBC Sport's Nick Hope that she would be willing to reconsider her position if the IPC apologised for the way she was treated. The IPC told the BBC that there has been no communication with Heather Mills or her management team over the last month and want to move on from the issue. It looks increasingly likely that there will be no last-minute change of heart from Mills and that she will miss the Sochi Winter Paralympics in March. This is heartbreaking news, Simon, for me. I imagine you feel the same, as I know you are a Mills supporter. I mean...
Are we all being facetious here, or are you being honest? Do you really mean this?
No, I really want to watch
Sorry, her. I thought you were waving the flag of irony loud and clear.
I want to see her hurtling down the mountain.
only because you think she's going to be rubbish. You think she's going to be like Eddie the Eagle Edwards.
Simon, is anyone going to watch the Paralympics now?
You remind me, wasn't she on one of those dancing shows?
Dancing on Ice, that's right.
Dancing with the Stars, was it?
No, was she on the Stars in America?
Yeah, in America.
Amazing.
She was, wasn't
so here
so
she was
did
on
it
Dancing
here
on
Ice.
Ice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crikey.
Simon, is anyone going to watch?
Now that she's not
now,
on
yeah.
the Paralympics. Mm. Well, I hope so. I don't think she was the biggest draw. There is, how do I say it? I think she's a serious competitor. I mean, it sounds unusual. She's 45, only took this up a few years ago, but she was spotted skiing by somebody and they said, you're good, you should go in for this. And she's won some medals at various different games.
So this wasn't just a complete novelty, then? It wasn't just a kind of cheap celeb punt to bring some publicity to Team GB? She genuinely has ability on the slopes.
When I first read it, I thought, oh, she's jumping on the back of sort of the feel-good Paralympics or something. Mm. But she's been doing this pre that. So I presume, yes. I mean, it depends what the competition is. And sometimes with Paralympic sports, you know, you're in very limited groups. So she might have very little competition. I don't know. But she was seriously training. She was good at what she was doing.
Bought a £1.4 million chalet in the Austrian Alps as a base for her training, which is what I read.
That's pretty serious.
So we now know where all the Paul McCartney divorce millions have gone. That's probably the Frog Chorus money.
Also, we have to remember she has just won the silver medal at the World Cup in New Zealand. So she is actually quite good.
Well, I don't know. That's my point. She could be in quite a tight field with the sort of category that she would be in. Nevertheless, she's been doing this for a few years at the pre-Paralympics. She got approval for the previous prosthetic limb in, I think it was July 2013, where everybody had to submit and that was all cleared. And then they noticed at a more recent meet in December that the prosthetic limb she was using was different. And then it all sort of kicked off, I think. And, you know, even the British team members were saying, don't go to this meeting, but she decided that she thought she'd perhaps represent herself better. It's a sort of a shame. I see what you're saying, Kate.
You've met her, haven't you?
Yes, I met her, but it's years ago. It was about 10 years ago at some sort of awards event. She has a brilliant ability that just sort of sucks you in completely. She also uses your name in every sentence, which is very endearing, Rob and Kate. I just remember meeting her for 5 minutes.
This guy is good.
He is good. He knows what he's doing.
Although beforehand, the stuff I knew about her, I thought, oh, I don't think I'm going to get on well with this person. 5 minutes later, I'm like, isn't she marvellous? She's just got something that is really, really strong and very powerful. She can bowl you over in a few minutes, but she did me anyway.
Wasn't the same event where she met Paul McCartney, was it?
We were vying for her, both of us. But he had the Frog Chorus, as you said, Rob.
Can't compete with that.
It was way, way before. Yeah.
Sometimes talent, not money.
The mobility scooter. I mean, Frog Chorus, mobility scooter.
You know what, this is even pre-mobility scooter days. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't an attraction in that sense. I just thought she had a presence, she had a power about her, and I can see why people would be sort of bowled over. And I'd also give credit to the Paralympic skiing people. To hear her verbally attack you, which is what she's alleged to have done, you're like, whoa.
Does this surprise you then? This vituperative attack.
This is the thing with her, isn't it?
From what you've just told me, this sounds rather out of character.
When I met her, we had a mutual friend, and she was polite and wonderful, and as I said, incredibly, she just sort of bowled you over. Was it at the end of the court, the divorce proceedings, where she poured a jug of water over Paul McCartney's solicitor? I think.
Oh, so she does have previous then, in terms of being a bit stroppy.
And also, I read her autobiography some years ago, and I found it a very curious read in that I never really felt I got the full truth. It was always, there was lots of hints and things in between the lines were going to be the more interesting bits. So I don't know. She's clearly a very interesting, perhaps slightly unusual woman, and obviously clearly very demanding. But
she's her own worst enemy, really, isn't she? She almost can't help herself from sort of losing. She's trying to keep herself under control all the time, and then something upsets her, and I think she just sort of flips too easily.
I suspect she is one of those people who would slam the table and say, do you know who I am? One of those sort of people, which generally doesn't help.
Where do you think she'll go next, then? If she can't ski, where are we going to see her next?
That's a great question. I mean, I know, more name-dropping, I did do a television documentary about the same time with her, a travel one. So she's done a bit of television presenting. I've no idea. I'm sure, because she is an interesting character, someone or somewhere will pick her up and there'll be something. But as Mary-Ann just said, maybe there's a limited amount of chances before people won't get involved with her. Who knows?
It's not too far away from Splash, is it? So, you know, one's hurtling down a mountain, another one's celebrity diving, throwing themselves off a diving board.
If I was to give her some advice, I mean, she doesn't do too many of the sort of celeb things. We've talked about the dancing stuff, but I presume she's just craving some sort of formal acceptance for something that's sort of not just about impairment, although obviously Paralympics has got a direct link. So.
But it's almost like her impairment has given her the celebrity status that she wanted. I mean, whether she'd have done that well as a model, I don't know.
Very true.
People have said a very cruel phrase about her becoming disabled was the best career move ever. Now, it is a pretty cruel thing to say. But
I want to defend Heather now. Because from my
this is exactly what she wants. We're playing into her hands.
But
now,
I suppose, is there a career move to be made in sport in that way? I mean, just do Olympians and Paralympians generate the same kind of sponsorship? And I mean, could it be seen as a career move, or is she just really like skiing? I don't know.
We should also mention that Heather obviously isn't here to defend herself. Heather, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the programme. Now, before we move on to our next topic, we're just going to do a quick Paralympic factoids. Should we race through these?
Indeed.
700 athletes from 45 countries expected to compete in Sochi.
Germany came top of the medals table at the last Winter Paralympics, with Russia coming second.
And the five Paralympic sports in Sochi will be alpine skiing, biathlon, cross-country skiing, sledge hockey and wheelchair curling.
The Games start on March the 7th.
And Channel 4 will be broadcasting it on TV with an expected 45 hours of coverage, and the BBC will have radio coverage on 5 Live. Mm. Now, one of this, you know what? I've been such a moron. I know that I'm, you know, not very up on disability, you know, affairs, but I've managed for the last few years to entirely miss the Undateables, which is, if you don't know, and surely everyone does, it's a fantastic show on Channel 4 whereby people with various learning difficulties and physical disabilities, we watch them on their pursuits to find love. And the third series started last week, and I watched the first episode, and I personally thought it was rather spectacular. Didn't you?
I avoided it like the actual plague.
Oh, you hate it?
And then I watched it, and I actually quite enjoyed it. But then I felt bad for enjoying it, because I then said, oh, isn't this lovely? Isn't this wonderful? And then I felt totally conflicted, so I didn't really know what to think. So, Simon, I kind of feel like you need to guide me on this. Should I be liking it or hating it?
I think that's down to you. Thanks for that. I'm giving Heather Mills advice. I'm sorting you two out. What's going on? But I do agree with both of your sort of sentiments. It's something that the title is just annoying.
Yeah.
And the concept is just to drag you in. And the idea is if you've got a disability, obviously you're in a smaller pond, or there's less fish in that smaller pond, and so on in terms of relationships. However, I mean, I've only watched two or three. And the way they do it, it's not quite plinky plonky piano sympathy music, but there's something uplifting about it. There's something that definitely draws you in. I saw the first of the new episode. I have a disclaimer. Oh, this is going to sound awful. Mary, who is one of the people I have met, he says, like, really clumsily now.
Is she the
which one is
short
Mary?
Person?
Oh, yeah. She was
the smoking
she was
hot,
hot
one.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, I met her at the World Dwarf Games in the summer, and one night we all went out for a drink.
Oh,
and
hello. She's not quite so undateable then, because
I was walking beside her, I was thinking, she's gorgeous. She's absolutely gorgeous.
And
I was dead chuffed that she was
next to me. The able-bodied man who she was dating was also extremely good-looking as well. I thought they were a very good couple. The gene pool was very high there.
I think she's kind of, because of the games, and she does a lot of sports, and he was a sort of fitness instructor, wasn't it? So, I mean, also, don't forget, she has also...
Is this wrong of me to be surprised with the fact that there's two really good-looking people on the Undateables? This is bad, isn't it? But I was surprised how hot they were.
I've seen quite a few hot people on there. Yeah. That's for sure.
I think you're alluding to something, which is where the show is going a bit wobbly and it can change its name, because Mary actually has a 16-year-old son. Now, I know you don't have to date somebody to get pregnant, but I'm presuming she's had relationships in the past. The other person has had a relationship in the past. So I'm kind of there. These are not undateable people. These are people who've been in relationships. So I wonder what the show's premise is now. Is it kind of we're just watching disabled people go out? I know it is harder. Maybe that's the a better.
But there's no difference, though, I thought, from watching it between seeing non-disabled people, like you going out on a date, as there would be with seeing disabled people go out on a date. I mean, there was one one part of the new episode where a guy with autism was dating a girl who had a stroke and I think had mild learning difficulties, and he took her for a milkshake. Yes. And it was this poor guy, he obviously really had a difficulty with asking questions, yeah, and thinking about other people rather than himself. And he was really doing well. You know, he was asking her lots of questions and she was just giving these monosyllabic answers. And I wasn't cringing because here are two people with learning difficulties out on a date. It just reminded me of the worst dates I've been on with able-bodied people. You know, so I think it's just a kind of prurience that we have. And actually, it's quite reassuring to know that both disabled and non-disabled people have the same crappy dates.
Although, can I just add a disclaimer here that I'm sat next to Rob, who has a very apparent love bite on his neck right at this moment. So I think, you know,
which will not be going up on the website. So
I'm pretty sure that Rob, you're not undateable, and I don't think Simon, you'd say you were undateable.
No, I just didn't realise we were back in the 1970s. Who does love bites?
An icky. I had a retro date. We went to a wimpy bar and
Can I just ask, Marianne, you have a son with Down syndrome. How would you feel about your son taking part in a programme like this?
I would be worried about how it would reflect on him. I wouldn't worry about how it reflected on me. Sadly, James had an experience when he was about 19 at a college for young adults with learning disabilities, where he was abducted by another student who also had learning disabilities, and she obviously fancied a bit, thought James was the one, took him off, and 2 hours later the police found them both in a barn. She was naked, saying, sort of, bring it on, James. She'd managed to get one shoe off James. He was sitting there with his back to her, saying, this is revolting, disgusting. And until that moment, he had had girlfriends, and a lot of French kissing went on. Since then, he's been totally asexual, absolutely nothing. And that breaks my heart for him, because he's a loving man and could have had girlfriends, but that was it for him. And it was a very sad experience. But I, if he went on something like that, he'd only go if Kylie Minogue was going to be his date.
And Nikki, what about your girls? Would you encourage Lizzie to do anything like that?
I think it'd just be up to Lizzie at the end of the day. I mean, I think the difficulty for me around the issue of carers and their approaches to their children's sex lives is as abhorrent to me as it would be if you with non-disability. And I think there's a, you know, you kind of get into a whole difficult area around, you know, you've got to be carer first, advocate second, and parent first. So it's, I can understand parents who are very keen to become involved, but I suppose for me it's along the lines of reading your child's diary. I don't know. I just feel... Do you know what I mean?
Part of you would rather not know as well.
Absolutely, because you're not meant to know, no. Are you, really?
And this is another thing that's all... A lot of those dates, there's no alcohol involved. I didn't see anyone have a glass of wine. In fact, maybe the dwarf woman...
Mary.
I think they might have had a glass of wine.
They were at a pub.
But there were also chaperones involved as well, you know, which
for
really
the people
can
with learning
crimp your style, I imagine. And so, it's an extremely difficult process, but I think it still makes for rather compelling television. We shall see. Anyway, there's another 5 episodes to go.
It's nice to know the dwarf woman has a name anyway.
Sorry, Mary. Well, this is the point. I mean, is mainstream TV serving disabled people now? I mean, do disabled people want their own programmes aimed at them? I mean, there's all this new technology around now. You know, if someone set up an entertaining YouTube channel for disabled people, I mean, do you see that working? Who would be on it? I mean, would you watch it? I'm throwing lots of questions there. Does anything prick your attention?
I think it's a good question. It's something that always rattles around my head. Is it mainstreaming or is it specific magazine programme? Don't forget, BBC Ouch is a specific disability aimed at a certain group. And
how brilliant it is.
Exactly. But also how many people download it and listen to it and read the website and so on. I don't know, it shouldn't be an either or for me. I mean, we did used to have very specific, we had a disabled production unit within the BBC. Was that 12, 15 years ago, something like that? And I remember reading all the set. They had good numbers, but a lot of the people watching weren't disabled people. So presumably it's about the content. I think you're quite right, Rob. Anyone could do this now. It's relatively easy to do. So I don't know. I do think it's about the content. Is it engaging? Is it interesting? Rather than just sort of the medium or the format it goes out in. Or I remember, again, 10 years ago, the big thing we wanted was both. We wanted actors in main, disabled actors in mainstream dramas, as well as the documentary stuff like Undateables. I don't think we've cracked that yet, and I do feel we're slipping a little bit back to just more documentary rather than mainstream. But there has been lots of good stuff that's changed that. So
disabled, like Liz Carr.
Exactly.
And Silent Witness.
Absolutely.
Yep, that's where I'm going off next.
Resident of this parish. Another one. I keep on losing my co-presenters to BBC One dramas.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because I always thought, you know, Liz would go on to something on Channel 5 during the day. Well, yeah, no, she surprised me.
I mean, Nikki, this is something that's quite close to your heart, I believe. You know, the trying to get disabled people onto television.
Mm. That all came out of Lizzie appearing in Dustbin Baby for the BBC, so they cast authentically,
which was the Jacqueline Wilson programme on CBBC, is that
yeah
right?
And in the original novel, the character of Poppy that Lizzie played had Down syndrome, but the type of school that the main character April has to go to is for behavioural problems, and they researched it, and the writer found that children with or young people with Down syndrome don't go to those schools anymore, so they changed her impairment to autism. So they cast authentically, and they did a shout out, and Lizzie auditioned and she got it, and it was coming out of that. And also my time at drama school was the first time since childhood, you know, where no one is supposed to affect or ape or copy or pretend to have or mock, and yet at drama school it's actively encouraged to portray characters with disabilities as a non-disabled person. There were no disabled drama students at my drama school at that time, and so it was just really that's where that first campaign came from.
You're known to many, Nikki, as a disability campaigner, and you're now, I hope you don't mind me saying your age, that you're now 47.
Yeah. You didn't give her a chance to say.
No, I didn't.
No, I don't want to say my age. Don't say my age.
Sorry, you're an indeterminate age. With both your children who are on the autistic spectrum in their late teens now. Now, you've been blogging about how your carer role has ended, and you're now wondering what to do with all this free time you've got. First of all, I mean, we'll move on to your comedy ambitions shortly, mm-hmm. but tell me a bit about your family and how much time you've had just for yourself over the last 20 years.
Not a lot, because as well as being primary carer for both the girls, obviously, I was also what's known as a sandwich carer. So my mum was diagnosed around about the same time as Lizzie was diagnosed. My mum was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, so she had Alzheimer's for a decade before she died in 2011. And I was able to maintain her in her own home for 5 years, but that was 3 years of me being her primary carer. So it was three meals a day, three sets of medicines and everything else that goes with caring needs, and then caring for the girls. So it's kind of like, again, there's a list, I think, when you're a carer, there's a very necessary list that you have to be at the bottom of. And after Mum died, and then the following year, Emily, unfortunately, with her challenging behaviours, it got to a point where, you know, we realised that a move that we'd always wanted for her to make into adult assisted living accommodation was necessary for that to come forward. So she went to a residential school.
So why was that? What were the trigger points for you making that decision?
I might cry, so please forgive me if I do. When any of my writing or my campaigning, I try not to focus on the negative side of Emily's condition, principally because she hasn't got an ability to you know, a right of reply to it, but also mainly because the challenging behaviours It's walking a line between identifying that and making people aware of it so that support services are in place and so that other people understand, but it's also protecting her privacy. So,
sorry to push you to be so specific,
it's
but
okay.
Is this this manifested in violent episodes?
Yeah, so right. I'd have broken bones, my coccyx were broken, my fingers were broken. Whereas a normal 15-year-old would turn around and say, F off, you've ruined my life, and I'm going off to the pub with my friends, and I'm going to get a tattoo, you know. Because they have this need to detach, their hormones are screaming detach. With Emily as a 15-year-old with a learning disability, that detachment is not as feasible for her. So that same resentment would build up and that need to detach, and that would manifest itself in violence. So,
and how's it been then? As you said, your mother passed away. Your mm-hmm. daughter Emily is now in adult assisted accommodation.
She's actually in residential. She's to a senior level of residential, so then she'll move into adult with the same.
And your other daughter Lizzie is no longer living at home as
no,
well.
No, she's
is that
still
right?
at home.
She's still at home. So you now only have one
yeah.
a person. And this must, I mean, do you feel a sense of liberation? Wow, suddenly I've got hours where I can do what I want. Or does it feel like a hole that is rather looming? And
I imagine it's like uncomfortable. Empty nest syndrome that most mums have, but times a thousand because
yeah.
it was so intense.
It was so intense. And I think the other thing is that how much our family had become controlled to the needs of one person. Emily made her life as small as was manageable for her. So she gave up school, she gave up respite, she wouldn't leave the house. She refused lots and lots of things. Everything was run to her control because she was so scared. And she brought everything within that. So the first few months were taken up with realising that what we had all as a family accepted as normal, in inverted commas, we had to then rethink our processes and realise that it wasn't, and that we had to, you know, open and expand our lives and try and work out kind of where we all were, really. So it took a few months in that sense. Obviously, her transition had to be very carefully handled. She left on a day of extreme... It was a very difficult day. I'm not going to cry, but it was a very difficult day. So obviously that all had to be then managed. You know, Lizzie had been spent most of her time in her room. She wasn't allowed out of her room. There were certain no-go areas in the house. It sounds really bizarre, and nobody plans for it to end up that... Oh, I'm not going to cry. Nobody plans for it to end up that way, least of all Emily, but you just find yourself in the position that you're in, and then you try and work out what you're going to do next.
Well, so what about you, though? I mean, how is this new time, these more hours in the day that you have for yourself? I mean, do you enjoy it?
It's very odd. It's like sprinting, and then you suddenly, whereas a sprinter will very sensibly wind down and stop, I kind of just came to a full stop, and I'd only known to do one thing, and that was care for other people for 20 years, and it sounds so silly. So you start sort of focusing in on, perhaps I should care for this person, and are you all right? And you sort of, I don't know, you fill your time in really bizarre ways. There's only so much housework you can do, and there's only so much... You know, and then you look to sort of think, well, now I need to find a career. And then you come up against a massive, great big, ooh, you appear to have a 20-year gap on your CV. And
How is Emily doing now? So how has that transition been for her?
Oh, it's amazing. She phoned me up on Sunday. She phones every Sunday. She phones up and she said, Emily been in a big car crash. And I was like, what? And I tried to explain. And basically she'd been stock car racing. So it was just like, once you get over the initial, whoa, you know, seeing Emily the birthday before Emily went in, there was, I'm determined not to cry, but there was a bouncy castle, there was a cake, and there were no guests, there was no one. The year after Emily goes in for her 16th birthday, she's dancing with a boy. And I'm sorry.
Well, that's wonderful. I know. To know that
there is
a real uplifting
it's
outcome.
It's got to be. And it's...
And you're doing the right thing for her and she's having fun.
Yeah. God, I'm really sorry.
Nikki, you've been campaigning for quite a while for the rights of disabled people in lots of different areas. And this means that you have been putting your head above the parapet quite a lot. You're on Twitter, you're very accessible to people, you blog, you know, you have comments open on your blog. And you have also been very outspoken about comedians like Frankie Boyle for his disability jokes, Ricky Gervais for using the word mong. And this has kind of led you to receive a lot of abuse online.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just quote you, if you don't mind, Nikki. This is from one of your online articles where you wrote, "Most venom is used to dissect my looks, my writing, COD diagnoses of my mental health, my time online in terms of my abilities as a mother, my participation in the breakdown of society as we know it, and my fitness to even discuss any of these issues that I campaign on, as I'm neither a comedian myself nor disabled." Mm. Some fairly strong invective there. So, I mean, tell me about the abusive reactions, I suppose, that you've had.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, the thing about being online, and it has to be said, especially as a woman, is that you do tend to draw, especially if you vocalise your opinion or you have an opinion that doesn't necessarily dovetail with the view of everybody else, you do tend to become subject to abuse in a very different way, I think, than men have been historically online. I think the reason I campaigned on the issues that I did, because obviously my first national campaign, and then I did People Not Punchlines, and that was the main thrust of that was bringing the hate speech laws in line with every other targeted group for hate speech. And whilst there's a caveat within law to say that if you are committing a different crime or another crime and you additionally verbally abuse someone on the grounds of their disability, then it possibly may or may not lengthen your sentence. And I just felt that this needed an amendment to the law. It's not drafting a whole new law. It's not a bill. It's not anything else. It's just a simple amendment, just the addition to every other targeted group for hate speech, the words, and disabled people. If you are in a drama and you use the bigoted language of bigoted people, you need to be free to do that because our writers need to reflect the people who live within our society. If you're a personality and you use what can be deemed to be hate speech targeting a group and their fans and followers will copy that, then I felt that should be just asking people to just reconsider what they say and what they do. It's not saying ban words, because there is a campaign to ban the word retard. Now, if that was the case, that would not be permissible within drama, and we need it. We need to be able to tell the stories. Documentary filmmakers need to be able to tell the stories. So that was the thrust of that, really.
And so I know your targets have included Ricky Gervais and Frankie Boyle, and yet you're now raising your head above the parapet once more in order to become a stand-up comedian yourself. I mean, it is...
What's your material? What are you talking about?
Well, I'm just talking about what I know, because that's the thing to do, the way to do it, the best approach, I feel.
Is it carer comedy then?
I call it carer comedy, yeah, which is... I mean, it's funny in and of itself, really, isn't it? Just that. But it's just talking about... It's not targeting... It's not holding up my life to say, as a non-disabled person looking in from the outside, this is what I found hilarious about what my children and my mum did. You know, it would never be that. It's more from a perspective of the things I observed, from the way other people responded to the girls and to some extent towards my mum.
So Simon, you've got a bit of a background in comedy as well, haven't you? Did you ever tread the boards?
Yes.
You did. Carer comedy, then. Is this a niche market that we need?
We set up, well, me and a friend set up Abnormally Funny People. In fact, Marianne, who's sitting here, was involved in some of that in the early days. This was disabled comedians, and we had our token non-disabled. That was the sort of the running strap line. The only bit, you're not even asking for advice, Nikki, and here am I being presumptuous.
Like any, but the bit
that you're giving everyone advice today, Simon, so, you know.
He's our agony uncle.
Yes, dish it out all round.
I would try and avoid putting yourself into a specific category, because I think that will limit other people's perceptions of you and what you might do. I totally get your bit about it's not just laughing at, you know, your family or so on and your relationship with them. It was more about other people's reactions. And that was very much, I think, where we were coming from, or of our comedy. And being self-deprecating, that's part of it. Mm. The bit that is always the challenge, and you'll go to venues and they'll kind of want, well, this is great, we'll get lots of disabled people. The bit for us is Abnormally Funny People, the thing we always we believe the disabled people will come anyway, so long as we're reasonably funny and, you know, strong and so on. So our challenge is to get those who are not interested in disability or, in your case, you know, being a carer, is getting that lot to come along and to get it and to enjoy it and so on.
Well, we do wish you the very best of luck, Nikki, by the way, with your burgeoning stand-up comedy career. May many members of the audience come along and pay... Here's a contrived link. Use their purple pounds in order to watch you play.
What is a purple pound,
How do you like them apples, right? Well, listen, let's start with the bleeding obvious, shall we? Well, green, obviously, colour of the environmental movement. Pink, the colour of the pound, as used by the gay community, for instance. And obviously, colours are adopted by movements and causes. But in recent years, the disability movement seems to be gradually erring towards purple.
Lovely.
The government often refers to the purple pound in its communications. Charities are picking it up too. But why, pray tell?
Well, we've been trying to track down where it came from, and most people have no idea. But we think that in this podcast, we might be able to uncover the roots and pinpoint the answer.
Yes.
Maybe, maybe not. Philip Connolly is the Policy and Communications Manager at Disability Rights UK, and he believes he may have been the first person to use the phrase purple pound in the UK in presentations back in 2011.
Can you back this up?
Well, we'll see. When did he first come across people linking the colour purple to disability?
I think I was researching a cultural vehicle to express the research I'd done on the economic part, contribution of disabled people to society. And I came across the Broken of Britain website with its discussion of colour. And they were advocating purple. And I thought, this is great. We can apply this to the economic power that I'm researching.
And their website and banner is a purple colour.
I think it is. It's some time since I looked at it, but I think you're sure that is the case.
Oh, you also heard Damon Rose of the Ouch podcast. We also spoke to Carlia Franklin. She's one of those behind the Broken of Britain campaign website that Philip mentioned, to find out why she thinks purple has emerged and why it's being used to describe the spending power of disabled people.
Ah, now... The phrase purple pound seems to come from the phrase purple dollar, which was used in America to describe the spending power of disabled veterans, and it comes from the Purple Heart. And then the first sort of mention we can find of it in the UK is in a think tank report, but it seems to have come into popular use after the Broken of Britain used purple as the colour of the logos and branding for the new protest movement in late 2010, early 2011. And that seems to be how purple got so associated with disability here. And as the phrase already existed, it seems to have come into popular use.
So the Broken of Britain liked the colour purple because of its political associations in the US, and their designer adopted it for the website, and it became a kind of protest colour in the UK as well. Now, during the welfare debate in the House of Lords, even Baroness Tanny Grey Thompson, our favourite, well, one of our favourite disabled people, aside from ourselves and Simon Minty and all of our other favourites.
You got out of that really well, Kate.
Yeah, thanks. She wore purple. Now, was this a message of solidarity, perhaps? Callia seems to think so.
So the colour appears to have stuck, but why did Philip decide to pick it up and run with it?
Purple was available, and it's a very good, exciting, vibrant colour to use, isn't it?
Wouldn't it have been a little bit more logical, perhaps, to call it the blue pound, because blue is the same colour as the badge that everybody's used to seeing?
Well, the badge is only used in transport, and obviously disabled people have needs in all spheres of their lives, and blue is already the colour that's used by the Conservative Party.
So not blue?
So no, not blue. Or red, or green, or yellow, or orange.
Because they're too political?
Well, because they're already associated with either political parties or, in the case of black, with political causes. Or brown, for example, is already associated with a political cause.
Which one?
Fascism.
It also makes him sound like he was speaking the lyrics to Snooker Loopy by Chaz and Dave there as well. I'm just thinking there's going to be a lot more disabled people wearing zoot suits from now on if purple becomes big. So, Mary-Anne, you've been sitting there very quietly and politely whilst we waffle amongst ourselves. Does purple do it for you?
Well, I don't know where it's come from. And, of course, as soon as Damon phoned me up and asked me if I had a clue, I had to be onto it like a rabbit. I haven't a clue. One person I spoke to said that a government minister at some stage said, well, pink's used to describe the gay pound, so what about disability? Let's use the purple pound. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Somebody else I spoke to said, well, maybe it was because the Remploy colour is purple and Remploy being associated with the government. I don't know. I don't know why it should be that colour. I just know that there is a poem about when I grow old, I shall wear purple. And so that seems to me to link it more to older people. But purple? Why purple? I have no idea.
When I first heard it, I must confess, I was trying to rack my brains to what the purple was. And I think the first instinct I had was older people. And I kind of remembered purple rinse that people would have in their hair. But then I thought, that can't represent...
Mauve. I suppose purple is a bit strong.
But it can't represent all disabled people. Or the other one I thought was because as disabled people, we fall over more, so we've got more bruises, so it's a purple. But I just could never pin it down. I still don't quite get it.
I mean, let's put a bit more meat on the bone of this then. Who is going to tell me what the purple pound is worth to businesses in the UK?
Well, I believe that it's theoretically £80 billion. This is a figure that's been used by the DWP for as long as that figure has been bandied about. But I think the big frustration is that we can't really substantiate it. I can't really get to the bottom of what this £80 billion comprises.
Yeah, well, we've been trying to track down how the £80 billion was actually calculated, and it seems to have emerged way back a decade ago in 2004. And our Ouch production team spoke to the Department for Work and Pensions. They told us that the actual math had been lost in the mists of time, that's useful, but was likely to have been created using raw data from the 2004 Disability Discrimination Act update and the Family Resources Survey from 2002 to 2003. They also tell us that they presently have no plans whatsoever to update this now 10-year-old figure. So I'm presuming it could be a lot higher than £80 billion now.
Well, it could be higher or it could be a lot less because of benefit cuts. Marianne, do you think disabled people have more spending power now than they did when this came out 10 years ago, or do you think we're reduced?
I really honestly don't know the answer to that, but all I know is that disabled people have money to spend. They have people who look after them, who will go where a disabled person can gain access to. They will use service channels that are as accessible as they can be. I am a baby boomer. I would not be classified as disabled under the Equality Act, but I'm 63 and I know that my hearing is changing, my eyesight's changing, my manual dexterity, my balance, just subtle little changes. And this therefore means that I think that the number of disabled people that that we are all told, sort of 11.9 million, I mean, it's got to be more than that, hasn't it? Because there are people like me who are all busy saying, oh, the acoustics in that restaurant are awful, I'm not going there again. And we're not disabled. So I think we just need to think more broadly and more inclusively than just looking at people who identify themselves as being disabled.
And presumably because of this, there's even more complaints about companies providing bad service to disabled people than ever before.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But I think a lot of disabled people are just so fed up with complaining and have maybe got consultation fatigue and don't see the difference happening anyway. I think the problem is that service providers generally have put in place reasonable adjustments, but they're just not maintaining them.
I mean, your company Really Useful Stuff brought out the Missing Out report just before Christmas, which was a look into disabled consumers. What were the headlines from that?
Well, the headlines from that were that basically, about half the respondents, and we had 350 people take part in this, they are not satisfied with the level of reasonable adjustments that they're getting when accessing high street service providers.
And who are the main offenders? Restaurants?
Well, we didn't look at
estate agents.
Well, estate agents, yes. I mean, I don't think they've even got the first rung of the ladder. I don't think they're on the first rung of the ladder. We looked at banks. Banks performed better than supermarkets, but still not well. Only 43% of the participants were satisfied with the with banks' accessibility. Only 40% of supermarkets. 30% of people were happy with mobile phone retailers, and a pathetic 20% of our respondents were felt that reasonable adjustments were in place to help them as disabled house hunters or people wanting to rent properties.
Give me a real example then. Give me a typical example of standard bad service for people with disabilities.
Well, I think it's the service providers are letting themselves down because banks, for instance, you'd have people saying that banks had put in place a low-level counter position for wheelchair users. But when the wheelchair user got to the front of the queue, that was position was closed. They would say, I need that position. Could you open it? And the bank teller would say, no, can you come over here? I can't open that counter. Induction loops, well, that is just a whole program in itself. Because although they've been put in place, very often they're not working. Mm. Reasonable adjustments in the form of alternative media, perhaps somebody wants large print or audio. And it, by the time they get the information from the bank, it's so out of date that it's of no use to them anymore. So I think that it's, generally speaking, a complete lack of understanding amongst staff. Staff awareness, disability confidence and competence scored appallingly badly. And I just don't think that the staff are giving the training that they need.
So, Simon and Nikki, have you ever boycotted a product or walked away from a business, a bank or whatever because of their abysmal, as Marianne has described, customer service towards people with disabilities?
Well, I mean, with Emily's needs and problems, yes. I mean, going to a restaurant is incredibly difficult. You go to very specific places. You go to places where she's happy to go, where they're happy. Again, one of the things about learning disability is the response from the service provider, in this case, you know, a restaurant or a shop. It was interesting because with my first campaign, one of the thrusts of it were to do with advertisers and why aren't disabled people routinely featured in, I don't know, holiday brochures or supermarkets or just children selling, you know, toys, not just in specifically disabled children, you know, products or toys. So I contacted the Office of National Statistics to find out, because as part of the research, I thought, well, if I could prove, you know, that the Office of National Statistics, who holds statistics on everybody, could tell me how much, you know, disabled consumers contributed. And they said, we don't hold statistics on disabled people as consumers.
Which is surprising, because you would have thought that especially big businesses are constantly collecting data on their demographics. You know,
yeah.
I mean, is this surprising to you, Marianne?
Yes, I think it's very important that we start to collect that sort of data. We know that a lot of service providers are very data-driven. Mm. So if there was some, it may be easier for consultants like us to actually encourage them to look more inclusively at all of their service across all their channels.
I think identifying people was difficult. I know for years and years, media, you know, you had your kind of audience figures and so on, but they'd measure everything but disability. And they said, we don't know who is who unless people identify. A few years ago, went to Muji, the sort of non-label Japanese kind of cool random shop, and I was taking a friend who was a wheelchair user, and I was kind of very pleased to show off the shop to them because they'd never heard of it. And there was just a step, which was, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches, but just enough to make it difficult to get in. And this was a 10-15 minute conversation when I was going in, asking them, could they put the ramp out? And they were saying, no, we can't be bothered. And it was right beside them.
They actually said to you, we can't be bothered.
Well, I think it was more of a kind of, we're really busy or something like that. And or they said, oh, can't, we'll just bump him in. And I said, no, that's not how it's going to work. And the joyous bit, I remember, I was saying, it was awful. And I said, well, I'm going to have to write to your head office. Can I have the address? And they said, no, we're not going to give it to you. And I looked at the till, and I'm the right height for looking right at the side of the till. And on the till was, this is our head office address. And I went, is it this one? And I went, yes. So for a few years, I had to boycott Muji just because of our bad customer service.
We should point out here that we don't have anybody from Muji here to defend themselves on this.
Have we got any examples of exemplary customer service?
Yes, let's bring a bit of positivity to this.
I have to tell you, McDonald's, when you've got children on the autistic spectrum, you can go into McDonald's in, I don't know, Barcelona, and you can go into McDonald's where I'm from, and you can go into any, and it's all exactly the same. So I must in the face of all other evidence to the contrary, I must say that the routine, predictable outcome of that is brilliant.
The Golden Arches experience is identical no matter where you are. Yes, I'm sure that's familiar to a lot of people. Simon?
I've heard from friends who are deaf who started migrating to Barclays Bank for their banking. One of the major reasons was you can do online sort of chat with the bank. And they said this is revolutionary for them. So a specific part of accessibility really does work. I talked to an estate agent recently because I was thinking of moving. And they looked at my flat and we went around it. They called me 3 weeks later and said, I hadn't even put it with them, it wasn't on the market. And they said, we've just met a lady who happens to be disabled and she wants to downsize. I told her about your flat. Could she just come round and have a look? Because this is going to... And I thought, this is quite cool. They're kind of, you know, confident with it and ultimately potentially selling the flat.
And Mary-Anne, final word from you on this very quickly. What constitutes good practice?
Just thinking inclusively from the very beginning of any development of product or service. Got to think about the widest possible usage of your services and explore innovative ways of enabling everybody to benefit from them. Because after all, if your customers can benefit, you're going to make more money.
Indeed. Well, thank you very, very much for your time, all three of you, Mary-Anne, Simon and Nikki. Thank you all.
Well, that's it for show 104. We'll be back next month. If you want to email us about anything you've heard, then we'd love to hear from you. ouch@bbc.co.uk.
And next month, we'll be kicking off our citizen correspondence. Now, apparently, we've been told that we have almost, or indeed almost definitely, found an assistance animal correspondent.
Yes.
At last. And a cures correspondent.
Amazing. Both amazing in different ways.
So what could you be a correspondent for? So serious or not so serious, we want you to keep your finger on the pulse of your subject and report back to us by phone into future shows. So it's the same address, ouch@bbc.co.uk. You can go to our website, bbc.co.uk/ouch for other ways of getting in touch.
Music this month is by Blessing Offer, his real name, a 24-year-old blind singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist from New York. Offer, who has been the opening act for The Temptations and Average White Band, is a member of Visionary Media, a New York charity which represents blind and visually impaired musicians. Find links to him from our website. His latest EP, Roots, will be released later this month, and here's the title track.
Goodbye.
No, no, don't make it easy. I want you to put me to the test. Love is most powerful in action. Love is most beautiful at rest. I'm not gonna stand with you for one night and leave you lonely. Not gonna tell you everything is alright and leave you broken when I'm gone. I just wanna put my roots down next to you now. I just wanna put my roots down next to you. Grow together, put our roots down. Grow together, put our roots down. No, no, don't try to change for me. I'll take you just the way you are. Please, please, please be easy with me. I've got miles on my feet, miles on my heart, but I've got plenty more miles in me left. Plenty more miles in me left. I've got plenty more miles in me left. Plenty more miles in me. I just wanna put my roots down next to you now. I just wanna put my roots down next to you.
together, grow together, put our roots down. Grow together, grow together, put our roots down. Put my roots down next to you now. I just wanna put my roots down next to you now. Grow together, put our roots down. Grow together,